they said, well, we can't have earmarks. We got to balance the budget. We transferred that power to the president.
A campaign to revive earmarks in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 15th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Sea Alaska Corporation posts a big operating loss.
This is just a condemnation of management and their accounting practices and their transparency.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
In Senator Ted Stevens' day, Alaska thrived on earmarks, the congressional practice of directing federal dollars to home state projects. Lawmakers agreed in 2011 to end the tradition in response to public outrage, particularly over projects such as Alaska's so-called Bridges to Nowhere. But now, as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, there's serious talk in Washington of bringing back the earmark.
Just a few years ago, earmark was a four-letter word in Washington, and to this day, nearly every account of alleged excess features as Exhibit A the bridge that would have connected Ketchikan to its island airport. Now, though, earmarks have friends in high places. Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid last week.
I have been a fan of earmarks since I got here the first day. Keep in mind, that's what the country has done for more than 200 years.
Democrats aren't united on this. President Obama opposes earmarks. Reid says he doesn't care.
I disagree, underline, underscore, big exclamation marks, with Obama on earmarks. He's wrong.
Among Republicans, the issue is also divisive. GOP senators debated it during a policy meeting last week. Opponents say earmarks are wasteful, while advocates say they may be the grease needed to break congressional deadlock. Alaska's congressional delegation, though, is solidly pro-earmark, with both senators on the Appropriations Committee, where most of the earmarking used to happen. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the stereotype is that earmarks fund obscure projects in the dark of night. More typically, she says, a city council passes a resolution supporting a project and asks her for help.
And they come to us and we put it on our website. And then people say, well, surely that's something that you would advocate as their representative back here in Washington, D.C. But did you know that that's called an earmark?
At least it is if the lawmaker writes it into a bill. Now Congress just sends money to the government agencies and they decide what projects to spend it on. So lawmakers who want to press for a project routinely contact agency chiefs to make their case. Murkowski says it amounts to earmarking in secret.
When you go through the back door, that is, I believe, taking you back to the days of the deal done in the dark of the night in the smoke-filled room.
There are other ways around the ban. A New York congressman, for instance, didn't direct any money to a ladder manufacturer in his district. But in a defense bill last week, he essentially orders the Army to brief Congress on the benefits of carbon fiber ladders. Senator Mark Begich says earmarking doesn't bust the budget. It only directs money within a budget.
You know, we're closest to the people in a lot of ways and understanding the needs. And I think to have us part of the process is important, and earmarks allow that opportunity to do that.
Alaska Congressman Don Young, in effect, made earmarking a household word by setting aside big money for the Ketchikan Bridge a decade ago. He says the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse, and Congress should use it.
I don't know what's wrong with my party. I frankly think they had their head in the sand. Is when they said, well, we can't have earmarks. We got to balance the budget. We transferred that power to the president.
But Speaker of the House John Boehner told Fox News this week, as long as he's in charge, the ban stays.
I started this effort in 2006 to get rid of earmarks. We are not going back to the nonsense that went on before then.
So far, the inertia seems to be in Boehner's favor. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Southeast Alaska's Regional Native Corporation has a $35 million net loss in 2013. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
Sea Alaska's annual financial report lists $165 million in revenues, more than $40 million less than the previous year. It also shows $35 million in net losses. Three-quarters of that came from its construction subsidiary, which badly underestimated two federal projects in Hawaii. The report, by the way, says that company's managers are gone and bidding on similar projects has stopped. Other losses came from land entitlement costs. Those include lobbying for federal legislation transferring Tonga's timberlands to the corporation. CEO Chris McNeil says despite the losses, Sea Alaska remains healthy. He says it's following a list of priorities developed about a year and a half ago.
One was to narrow the scope of our operations from companies that don't fit our strategic plan anymore, and we sold the Niprokanak operations, notwithstanding the fact that they were all profitable at the time that we sold them.
The corporation is headquartered in Juneau and has close to 22,000 Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian shareholders. More than half live outside Southeast. Shareholder and longtime critic Brad Flitch says Sea Alaska's losses are a sign of poor management, and he says shareholders should have been informed earlier.
This is just a condemnation of management and their accounting practices and their transparency. To me, it's evident of manipulation of shareholders.
The annual report shows a total loss of more than $50 million. Investments, profitable ventures, and resource earnings from other native corporations shrunk that to $35 million. CEO McNeil says the board and managers are looking for new areas of growth.
We need to be able to acquire another company in order to provide both the income and the opportunity for sustainable development and potential for employment or empowering and capacity building for our own tribal member shareholders.
Flitch doesn't like that idea. He's pushed for smaller regional business development, such as growing and selling berries or flowers.
When you read the annual report, their whole thing is about going out and buying another company, which scares the living daylights out of me. Shareholders cannot afford any more major write-offs. We actually have to start making money.
Sea Alaska's annual report comes out at a time of corporate transition. McNeil is retiring, and a new CEO should be in place this summer. Longtime board president Albert Kukesh is stepping down, though he'll continue as a director. And board member Byron Malott, a former CEO, is leaving to concentrate on his run for governor. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
With 3 months to go before the primary election, groups with a stake in the oil tax referendum are ramping up their campaigns. Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway, which sponsored the ballot measure, recently opened up campaign headquarters in Anchorage. They also hired a full-time campaign manager late last month. TJ Presley says they're running a hyper-local campaign focused on canvassing and social media.
I think politics is changing these days, and it's kind of getting a little more advanced and more targeted. So I don't know that blasting TV ads across every channel at every time is always the most targeted way to get things done.
Presley says they're following up with the 40,000 registered voters who signed their petition and trying to identify voters who would likely support their effort. Because the group has raised less than $200,000, it can't compete on the airwaves and has not spent any money on television advertisements.
We don't have $10 million, so we got to focus our resources where they're going to be most effective.
A few blocks down the street from the Vote Yes headquarters, a rival group has also set up shop. Vote No on One, which wants to keep the new tax law in place, opened up their own campaign offices this month. But they've been running campaign commercials since last year. Willis Lyford, a spokesperson for the group, says their campaign has been in full swing a long time compared to the referendum sponsors.
Better late than never, I guess. I mean, we've really invested a lot of time in outreach across the state.
According to filings with the Alaska Public Offices Commission, Vote No on One has raised more than $8 million. Most of that money comes from Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and BP, who all have major oil operations on Alaska's North Slope. The tax law targeted for repeal was signed last year, and it caps the oil production tax at 35%. The law was pitched as a way to spur production on the aging North Slope oil fields, but critics say it means less tax revenue for the state. According to a recent survey by the firm Public Policy Polling, 45% of people support the referendum, while 34% want to keep the new tax law in place. The vote on the referendum will be held on August 19th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Olympic-caliber coach mentors young Alaskan boxers.
It felt like a video game. Like, there was no one outside. It's just me and him inside a little ring.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
This week, the State Assessment Review Board, or SARB, has been holding hearings in Anchorage over the dispute in how much the Trans-Alaska Pipeline should be worth. Municipalities and boroughs that the TAPS line runs through collect taxes on the line, and those officials believe the value should be $13.7 billion. The pipeline owners who pay the taxes say it should be $2.7 billion. The Alaska Supreme Court recently reaffirmed a lower court decision that put the 2006 value of TAPS at nearly $10 billion. The State Assessment Review Board's job is to look at all sides and decide what the tax value should be. The decision will mean millions in tax dollars, either in savings for the companies or in revenue for the municipalities. Matt Buxton has been covering the arguments this week for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner and joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Lori.
Matt, these numbers represent a huge divide in how the various sides see this TAPS valuation issue. What have the arguments been on the industry side for why it should be lower?
Well, the arguments from the oil companies this week have largely focused around the cost to replace the pipeline as well as the depreciation value of the pipeline. The oil companies are arguing that the methodology that both the state and the municipalities are applying to the pipeline are inflated.
What about the attorneys for the municipalities? How are they making their case?
The municipalities are really leaning on the Superior Court decision that was upheld by the Supreme Court earlier this year. The Superior Court decision is a little complicated, but it essentially ends up with a pipeline that is much more expensive to replace, and that's largely due to the amount of perceived oil that's left on the North Slope that is still valuable.
Has anyone talked about, the governor says his new oil tax regime is going to bring a whole lot more production. Has anyone discussed the idea that more production would mean more oil in the pipeline? Are they talking in terms of what the future may look like if there, more production comes online?
One of the really big numbers is how much oil is going to be left on the North Slope and how many years left the pipeline has to operate. The Supreme Court has put that around about 50 more years, 40 to 50 years of oil. The state agrees with that. Municipalities say there's a little bit more. Oil companies are saying a little bit less. But however, the oil companies are arguing that the value of the oil really shouldn't be a factor here, that they likened it to a garbage truck. A garbage truck would have the same value whether it's hauling garbage or hauling diamonds. So it's still a truck.
Matt, which municipalities are impacted by the outcome of these hearings? And what would a lower valuation mean for their coffers and potential impacts to residential property taxes?
So the pipeline runs mainly through three municipalities. That's going to be the North Slope Borough, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and the Valdez Borough. For Fairbanks, the pipeline value has already become a big issue this year. The state assessor said that value the pipeline at about $5.7 billion for this year. That's about half of what the SAR board decided last year. For the Fairbanks North Scarborough, that's about $400 million less of property value. What that means for the budget and taxes is that there's just less money. Property taxes are slated to go up for everyone in the borough. And if the oil companies get their way and the SAR board reduces the value even further, that could really affect the borough's savings.
Matt, what about the state? Where is their role in the sides here of this issue?
They've really come down in the middle right now. Traditionally, they've really sided with the oil companies. So far, they've taken issue with the high value set by the courts, but they also haven't totally reversed to their previous decisions, which have been much lower. So they're definitely increasing since the court decisions, but they haven't gone all the way to the municipality. Their number is really pretty close to the middle right now.
Matt Buxton is a reporter for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. One of the three SARB members is Bernard Washington. Washington is the chief financial officer for Alaska Public Media, the parent company of APRN. Travelers heading to the Anchorage airport this summer to catch a flight could face one less hurdle before they make it out of town. The Transportation Security Administration is offering flyers the chance to be streamlined through security checkpoints. APRN intern Jolene Almendarez has the story.
The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, is allowing low-risk passengers the chance to opt out of more rigorous security screening. The pre-check program launched in December. TSA spokeswoman Lori Dankers says 1,700 people have enrolled in Anchorage so far. That prompted the TSA pre-check enrollment center at the University Mall to increase its appointment availability from 2 days a week to five.
You can just go and provide the documents to prove identity and citizenship. They'll take your fingerprints there. There is an $85 application processing fee. That's good for 5 years. And when we process your information, you are given a known traveler number, and it uniquely identifies you to TSA as being cleared for TSA pre-check.
Pre-check travelers can keep their shoes and belts on and leave laptops and most liquids and aerosols stashed inside their carry-ons. Dankers says the option to volunteer additional information in lieu of going through traditional security measures allows for TSA to avoid a one-size-fits-all approach to passenger safety.
One thing for people to remember that even if you go through the TSA pre-check expedited screening lane, those passengers are still screened. They're just screened in a different way. So we feel like by combining all these levels of security, we can offer expedited screening to those passengers who are pre-cleared.
Dankers says the enrollment center takes walk-in customers, though appointments are recommended and can be booked as far as 30 days in advance online. The benefits can be used at any of the 118 airports participating in pre-checking throughout the nation. In Anchorage, I'm Jolene Almendarez.
The Clearwater Lodge near Delta Junction burned to the ground this morning. The Rustic Lodge was a popular gathering place for fishermen, birders, and others who come to the Clearwater River. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
The fire was reported around 3 a.m., and all that was left at about 10 this morning was a pile of smoldering rubble. There were no injuries, but Clearwater Lodge co-owner Patsy Ewing was clearly exhausted after a nearly sleepless night.
It's overwhelming.
Ewing was fielding questions from the local fire chief while entering phone numbers and other data into her cell phone, which was constantly buzzing in her pocket with texts and Facebook posts from friends and well-wishers.
Oh, I'm still spinning, but it's the people contacting me has been amazing. I felt a lot of care and concern and
a lot of support from the local.
Absolutely. My phone is blowing up with people saying, you know, you okay? We're so sorry. And it's just amazing.
The lodge was a total loss. Rural Deltana Fire Chief Tim Castleberry estimated damages totaling about $1 million. He's just begun investigating, so he can't say right now what sparked the fire.
We're not sure. It's looking like it possibly started in the basement, but once things cool down, we'll be able to get
and look a little bit more.
But it's not just a dollar and cents loss. An important piece of Delta area history also went up in smoke this morning. The lodge was built back in the late 1950s by Al Remington, who, along with a half dozen others or so, settled in the Clearwater area around then and developed it. Patsy and her husband Kevin bought the lodge in 2001 from Al Remington's grandson, Mike Lentz. The lodge was known far and wide over the years as a headquarter for local snow machine races. It's even more widely known by folks from all over who come here for a meal and a cold one after a day fishing on the Clearwater. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage, and other diseases. More information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Caribou users in the Northwest Arctic Borough were told yesterday that North America's largest herd declined by more than a quarter in just 2 years. The group also questioned state officials on how a proposed road to the Northwest Arctic Borough would impact subsistence resources. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Yesterday, the Unit 23 working group met in Kotzebue for its yearly meeting on the health of subsistence resources. And in the Northwest Arctic Borough, that means caribou, first and foremost.
The herd size right now, as of 2013, was 235,000 caribou, and that's down about 27% since 2011. So a big, big decline in the last 2 years.
Jim Dow is a wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He spoke to the group on what's driving the herd's sudden decline.
Based on what we've seen, we think weather events, especially during winter, these winter thaws with rain and ice, that probably started the herd down. When the herd started down, we had increasing numbers of wolves and bears. Everybody, you know, from the villages saying, lots of wolves, lots of wolves. That's what I see, lots of wolves.
Unit 23 refers to all of the hunting grounds in the Northwest Arctic Borough. The working group came together years ago as a way to ease worsening relations between different groups of caribou users. Jan Caulfield moderates the group's meetings, a job she says has gotten a lot easier. Now, the group acts almost like a forum on issues facing caribou, like a proposed industrial access road which would stretch over 200 miles from the Dalton Highway to the Ambler Mining District. They're not against the road, but they are raising questions.
One of the main interests of the working group in the proposed road project is just any impacts that it might have on the caribou herd, impacts that it might have on how people access the area and whether there would be increased public access to the area that might increase the number of hunters that come or the areas in which they can go.
Caulfield introduced two speakers from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, ADA, who spoke on the status of the road.
We wouldn't build the road unless we had a financial model that worked.
Mark Davis is a deputy director with ADA. The agency is getting permit applications together in the next few months. And throughout Wednesday's meeting, they were upfront that there won't be firm answers available on environmental impacts, jobs, cost of living reductions, or effects to subsistence before more data is gathered for reports.
We believe that it has been demonstrated in Alaska that you can build a road and still maintain healthy populations of subsistence resources. So that's our goal.
That's Mary Ellen Tuttle, the other presenter with ADA. She works for Dow HKM, a private company with a lot of experience building and consulting on roads in Alaska. The Unit 23 working group met again today in borough chambers to hear more from state and federal agencies. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska isn't exactly known as a hotspot for boxing talent, but an Olympic-caliber coach is hoping to change that. He started the Alaska Boxing Academy 2 years ago and already has a few athletes who are dreaming big about competing nationally and internationally. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Arthur Tawa Ili'ili hops lightly on the balls of his feet, jumping rope, warming up for today's training session. He's in the Fairview Rec Center in Anchorage with about 20 other boxers who are mostly beginners. Once the warm-up is over, Arthur breaks off from the rest of the class with the more experienced boxers and starts throwing punch combinations as he circles a punching bag. Arthur is only 12 years old, but he's been boxing half his life. His first fight was about 2 years ago.
It felt like a video game. Like, there's no one outside. It's just me and him inside a little ring. And I forgot about everybody out there cheering, crying. It's a great experience for me.
Getting to the level where he could fight took a lot of time, but Arthur says it was worth it.
When you first come here, you don't spar yet. You just do basic stuff. It's kind of boring when you start because all you do is jab and all that. But then once you keep boxing, it'll get really fun.
Arthur's coach is David Carey, the founder of the Alaska Boxing Academy.
Sit. Box. No plan, patty cake. Let's go. Work the jab.
Carey was a member of the U.S. Olympic team that competed in the 2008 Games in Beijing. After boxing in the Olympics, his plan was to turn pro, but those plans were altered when a bicep tear sidelined him for a year. While he was recovering, he spent some time training at a gym in Anchorage, where a young boxer introduced himself.
There was this kid that came in with his cousin. His name was Nino Delgado, and he came in with his cousin Ricardo, and they said they want to box. You know, they see my newspaper clippings on the wall, they see my pictures in Russia and on the Great Wall of China and stuff like that. He's like, oh, you know, I wanna go to the Olympics one day. I wanna win the Golden Gloves. He said, I wanna train, I wanna box. And I said, okay, you know, it's not gonna be easy. But if you're willing to listen to what I'm going to have you do and go through all the training, I'll train you.
After training Nino for a couple months, they went to the Junior Golden Gloves tournament in Tacoma, Washington. Nino won the tournament. That was almost 6 years ago, and Nino, who is now 18 years old, hopes to make the U.S. national team next year. Even though he hasn't been fighting for very long compared to many of his competitors, he believes he can earn a spot.
We try to make up for inexperience with hard work.
If Nino makes the team, he'll have a chance to go to the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Nino's success is something Carey wants to make more common. He would like to see amateur boxing draw more attention around the state.
What people really in Alaska, what they need to realize is that we have talent up here, not just in hockey, not just in the winter sports. We have talent in mixed martial arts, boxing, football, basketball. But for fighting, we have really good fighters up here.
Nino has helped Carey prove that claim. And as Nino prepares to move on to the next level, Arthur says he has some lofty aspirations of his own.
My dream is to go in the Olympics and then win and become a professional boxer.
Carey says with enough motivation and dedication, it could happen. And he believes there are more Alaskans like Arthur and Nino who can compete at the world's highest levels. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Zachariah Hughes in Nome. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Jolene Almendarez from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.